Hi, everyone. Welcome to our Big Unlock podcast. My name is Ritu M. Oberoi, and I'm the co-host of the podcast, and really happy and excited to have Dr. Ruchi Garg here with us today. This is season 7 of our Big Unlock podcast. A very warm welcome to all our listeners, and we're really inching towards 200 episodes, so we're really excited. It's been, you know, going on for a while, and we're always happy to bring you fresh perspectives. So Dr. Ruchi Garg is our guest today. She's the Chief Medical Officer at Fairview Park Hospital, where she's deeply engaged in delivering high-quality patient-centered care in a community hospital setting. She's a gynecological oncologist with a demonstrated history of working in the higher education industry, and her work reflects a strong commitment to advancing care delivery through thoughtful adoption of technology and process innovation. She's particularly passionate about addressing physician burnout and enhancing care access for diverse and underserved populations. Today, she's joining us here on the Big Unlock podcast to share her insights on the evolving role of clinicians in shaping the future of healthcare. So really happy to have you here with us, Dr. Garg. Welcome, and it's all yours. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and thanks for that generous introduction. And I look forward to a wonderful conversation here today.
Great. So, you know, our listeners always love to hear an origin story. And like I was telling somebody the other day, you know, now we're coming up on 200 episodes, but we still hear like such interesting things when we ask people about how they got into healthcare and how they kind of got into this intersection of healthcare and technology. So we would love to hear what was your inspiration and, you know, what led you into healthcare and what keeps you going in this field? What motivates you?
Absolutely. So it's interesting. I always actually give a funny story about what got me into healthcare. Being of Indian origin, growing up, we used to laugh that Indians always going to either become engineers or doctors, right? So, and when it was 10th grade, I still remember I was doing a summer course. It was electrical physics course, and I was learning all about circuitry and all that. And it dawned in the middle of that summer that I'm just not going to be as good of an engineer as my dad. So let me become a doctor.
Okay. So it goes by the process of elimination rather than.
But no, I mean, mathematically inclined, a STEM child, and you know, how can I make a bigger impact on the world? And my family is always of the belief that you don't have to follow your parents' pathway. You have to sort of build upon it. And how do you contribute more, have a, you know, bigger impact? So really, that's what led both my brother and I actually into medicine. And going through the medical training, I actually never thought I was going to be a surgeon and a GYN oncologist at that. I thought I was going to be the child who's going to faint at the sight of blood. And there are some funny stories from medical school and my experiences, but really I loved my surgical rotations. I loved the immediacy or the immediate impact that you can have on the patient's life. And the more complex the surgeries were, the more I loved them. So I remember going through hepatobiliary rotation and doing some Whipples, like massive pancreatic resections or liver resections. And I loved every minute of those 6 to 8 hour surgeries. And then I went through GYN oncology rotation and I was hooked. Us GYN oncologists, we're definitely a unique breed. We love to work hard and play hard. And it's a unique subspecialty because you get to have your patient throughout their journey of whatever disease pattern it may be. So I've had 8-year-old patients, unfortunately, but I've also had 96-year-old patients. Mm-hmm. And I've had, you know, patients where I've done prophylactic surgeries and prevented cancers in them because they're at high risk. But then I have had, you know, I've diagnosed their cancers, I've done their surgeries and treated them for their chemotherapy, and then also, you know, held their hand when they've passed. And that's pretty much what attracted me to GYN oncology, where we're trained to do all of those aspects. We're trained to do prophylactic surgery. We're trained to do the big complex surgeries. We're trained to do chemotherapy. We're trained to do end-of-life care for our patients and build that relationship with our patients.
Nice. Thank you. It's very inspiring to hear, and the amount of effort and work you put in, it's just incredible. I'm always in awe whenever I talk to physicians, and it's like, you know, I think it's a calling. It goes like way beyond a profession or, you know, a job or It has to be something else that keeps you going. So thank you for sharing that. So let's talk about a little bit more about the, you know, favorite current topic at hand, which at HIMSS or Vive, you couldn't walk like more than a few steps without hearing about AI. So tell us in, you know, in your current role, what do you see happening there? And how do you, you know, we hear a lot about physician burnout and about how clinicians are actually walking away from the field. So like a personal story where you've seen where it's really moved the needle and maybe, you know, helped you to reclaim some time, or what are some successful implementations of AI that you've seen that really make you feel that, you know, this is like a pivotal moment?
Sure. Let me step back a little bit as to why I got hooked on to health tech. So the taste really came from COVID times. As soon as COVID occurred, I was in private practice in Northern Virginia at that time, and we were a very busy practice, but it was a practice where we also did academic training. Mm-hmm. So we had fellows and we did some research as well. Because of the wide spectrum of the practice, we couldn't skip a beat when COVID came, right? Because cancer didn't stop. So within a week, I was able to set up telehealth program in my practice. And fortunately, we had, you know, there were companies who had advertised enough and we were able to connect up with them. So our patients continued to get the care. And then, as I mentioned, we had our own chemotherapy suite as well that we were managing patients, and those patients needed to get vitals. But those patients, as you can imagine, are very vulnerable, and especially during COVID times, they were a really high risk population. So we didn't want to bring them into the office unnecessarily. So needed to figure out innovative methods. I connected with a startup company that was doing remote patient monitoring at that time. And we were able to do that. We were able to deploy monitoring tools to these patients and then have their vitals from their home be passed on to us, and then do telehealth visits with those patients. So the only reason they had to come into our clinic was for labs and for infusions. So really minimizing the visits. And obviously the world learned, right? What all you could do at that point. Absolutely. Really build upon it. And the patients liked it, right? Because it was convenient and they didn't have to come to the office for every single thing that needed to be done to them in their care paradigm. And I was involved with a similar sort of monitoring program at the cancer center when I was there and built upon that. But really, when the AI tech took over and has, you know, started over, there is so much more that we can do. And that's where my interest of really streamlining healthcare and building efficient protocols and having more standardized approach and intertwining that with our day-to-day care as well as and utilizing AI, that's when, you know, the wheels started turning. And I was fortunate enough to partner up with a company called Risa, and initially they were a space agnostic AI-based prior authorization company. They had built their platform, and within 2 months, I was brought on as an advisor. And in our conversations, we had multiple hours long conversation, and we realized that the space that I was in fact, the oncology space, was where we could make the biggest impact. And the company shifted their focus. You know, because when you have an oncology patient, you know, you're getting the prior authorization for all of those steps that I just talked about. You know, it could be prophylactic surgery, it could be the big surgery, it could be for CAT scan, it could be for chemotherapy. But then, you know, if the cancer comes back for repeat chemotherapy or immunotherapy or radiation therapy, any of that. So one patient, you can have a huge impact on. And you know, the world's changing and the prior authorization process has become really cumbersome. And 15, 17 years ago, when I started practicing, I would probably do a peer-to-peer review with the insurance company maybe once a month, you know, if that. And by the time I stopped practicing, so I've stopped practicing a couple of years ago when I took on a full-time administrative role. But I will tell you, the last few years of my practice, I was probably doing at least one or two peer-to-peers every week.
Wow.
And that's quite burdensome. And that delays care, that adds anxiety to the patient. It adds tension between the clinical team and the patient relationship as well, because the patients think you're not doing your job and you're working within the constraints and making sure that we get things approved for them so that they're not stuck with this huge bill, right, at the end, while dealing with all the other patients as well. So the buck doesn't stop with one patient, unfortunately. So that's where these kind of technology are making a big difference and are going to continue to make a bigger and bigger impact. But the key here is that that company listened to me as a clinician. And we can't just be throwing tech around without having the voice of the clinician, the voice of the frontline folks involved in shaping that technology.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think many points in your answers, but I think repeatedly we hear from everybody that COVID was what, you know, really normalized telehealth and really kind of kickstarted this whole wave and just made it so much easier for people to accept these virtual visits and, you know, like remote monitoring that you're talking about. So that's a great example. So thank you for sharing that. So yeah, I was asking about particularly successful implementation of AI that you've seen in your community hospital. So other than this oncology company that you talked about, like usually we hear, you know, about ambient or voice agents. So what has your experience been with any of that? And if you would like to share something on those topics.
Sure. So I'm part of Fairview Park Hospital, which is a small facility within the larger HCA system. And HCA has definitely, they have taken a very centralized approach to deployment and application of these AI technologies so that they can do it in a controlled, standardized manner, and as well as put some guardrails around data protection and cybersecurity. So, you know, a very thoughtful approach. And what has been done so far is we have AI-based ambient listening deployment for our physicians, one of the technologies that's been done. And my physician services group doctors who are utilizing this technology, mainly my surgeons, they each say that it has saved them about an hour and a half, 2 hours every day of charting.
That's huge. Yeah.
That's huge.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you can just see the amount of burden that takes away, the physical strain as well, but also the accuracy. Because if you are waiting till the end of your day to do the notes, you're going to miss things, right? And it's really hard. Like, we don't have time built in between patients, each patient, that you can use that precious time, the daylight hours, to do the documentation. So a lot of the documentation does occur at the end of the day. But now with the implementation of ambient listening, the documentation is happening in the moment. And that allows for more accurate documentation, and it allows for a faster turnaround as well, because I was extremely inattentive about it, that my notes had to be done before I left for the day. But not every physician is able to do that, you know? And I mean, you know, and I'm sure even me, like, I probably, you know, there is at least 1% of time that I missed doing that. Then there's delay in care, because it's not as if you have the next day lined up to do documentation. You have more stuff that's happening.
Exactly. Playing catch up.
So there's a lot of opportunity to build beyond that. So the ambient listening, you can take it the next layer deeper. It can do, and it's not deployed yet, but that is, I'm 100% sure, the future, right? The AI can then fill in the orders that need to come after, you know, the follow-up orders, or the filling of the prior authorization forms, or the filling of requests for surgery or requests for CT scan. So all of that, it'll just be a faster turnaround and more accurate turnaround.
Great. Yeah, I think a lot of companies are working on that rather than it being like a one-point solution, to actually integrate it into the workflow so that you actually, and especially with agents, I think maybe, you know, that will happen, because then each agent can kind of just fire off and do the next step. So maybe we'll see that happening very soon. So my next question is more, you know, about your leadership role. So when you're heading clinical teams, you know, when you're leading them through change, whether it's new technology, new protocols, or new care models, we are hearing a lot of things about, you know, responsible AI and trustworthy AI. So what's your approach to building trust that gets you, you know, true adoption rather than passive compliance? Because that's something we've heard again, that it can't be a diktat. You can't be, you know, just saying, okay, from tomorrow, you're going to use this. So how do you actually like convince the physicians that the impression is that everyone's really resistant to change and they're super busy, like you said. So how do you learn something new, and how do you integrate it into your workflow?
I think that's where, you know, going back to the prior comments, that really partnering up with clinicians or providers, you know, if it's a provider solution or if it's a nurse solution, then partnering with the nurses, the appropriate frontline worker, to understand the workflow and the user space and decreasing the burden. When it comes from that point of view, that you're decreasing the burden and you're going to make them better and more efficient, and oh, by the way, it's going to help the patient more, that's the approach. If you sort of go back to the EHR, even though the EMR is a prime example of what you just said, right, that it was sort of, we all had to just swallow the pill.
Exactly.
You know, and it didn't get built with clinicians in mind. So everybody talks about death by 1,000 clicks, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So I remember when I came in my role, and one of the complaints or concerns that my clinical informatics team had brought to me is that our clinicians are just not discontinuing the telemetry, which is, you know, the further, more careful monitoring of the patients. And that they're good at placing it, but they're not discontinuing it when it's time to take it away. So then we're running out of telemetry boxes to utilize on the next patient and are having to beg the doctors, okay, can we discontinue? This patient is done utilizing. And I was like, well, why don't you walk me through the workflow? It was one click to order the telemetry. It was four clicks to DC it, discontinue it. I was like, there's your answer. Four clicks, four screens. That's why you're not getting the discontinue until they need it for their own patient, then they're discontinuing it, right? Very silly example, but you add up, you know, those extra three clicks throughout the day for various things. That's when you get the barriers for deployment. And that's how we have to think about it. So even with this, the AI platform, if it stops, you're going to get the doctors used to, okay, ambient listening, my notes are done. I'm going to just have to review them and take ownership of that, obviously. But then now you want me to sit down at the chart and order all the other things and all of that. When the technology can easily do that, the human mind is going to get greedy. And that's exactly the direction. That's how we have to approach it, that we have to show how it benefits them and the patients. Mm-hmm. And take away the burden.
So we've been hearing a lot about all these successful implementations of AI for digital front doors, for ambient, for things that are kind of removed from the actual practice of medicine. But now slowly we are seeing the move towards, okay, AI can do more. It's, you know, diagnostically reaching those levels where it's, you know, passing all these exams. You know, you kind of hear about it can almost do, like, so many millions of people all over the world are turning to ChatGPT for, you know, health related questions and actually putting in like their entire histories and getting back like diagnoses. So what are your thoughts on this trend, and where do you think, you know, you draw the line between like what can a physician do versus, I guess I'm trying to say, should the human in the loop stay, or is it just going to move beyond that? And when do you think the time horizon for that is going to be? Like, how soon is that going to happen?
I think the writing's written on the wall, right? We can keep denying it, but there is some low-hanging fruit and some standardized protocols that obviously AI is trained on already, right? Many of the AI agents. And so do patients really need to go to a doctor to get diagnosed with a URI and get antibiotic prescribed to them? But, hey, I've had now three infections in a month. Now you want to, or I've had three infections or four infections in 2 months. You want the next level of critical thinking. And yes, the AI will get there. So the AI will get more trained, right? As we as doctors, even in these settings, right? Ambient listening, what is happening there? The AI is getting trained, right? Absolutely. It's getting trained on the critical thinking. As we make the changes, as we talk to it, it's going to get to that deeper level training. So, I mean, the writing's written on the wall. The question is, who's going to take the liability? And I think this is where the world of medicine is hung up on at this point, because it would be very easy to deploy that throughout primary care settings, for example. But if the AI is hallucinating, or if there's incorrect diagnoses, because there's a lot of gray zone, right? And that's what we call differential diagnosis. Who's going to take ownership of that? And if there's something wrong or there's a bad outcome, is it the AI company, the technology company, that's going to get sued? We unfortunately live in that kind of litigious society, right? Or is it the doctor who has the malpractice insurance? One of the things that I always say is that doctors are not allowed to be humans. We're not allowed to make any kind of human-related error, because if that error happens and it leads to a bad outcome, it's very unfortunate. And then you have to deal with the consequences of that. Whereas you do take away some of the human factor, but you introduce some other glitches.
Glitches, yeah. No, I totally agree with you. And I think it's a very evolving field, and we're going to see a lot of this happening, because like at Hims and Wife, we heard a lot about these health deserts, you know, where there's no access to care, or maybe like, you know, in rural communities. So if you have some care, is that better than having no care at all versus having, you know, patients wait for a long time? So it's an interesting topic, and we'll have to closely watch and see what happens there.
And that's exactly, I mean, that, you know, you hit the nail on its head. Like, yeah. That's exactly it. I mean, that's where we're going to have to show the benefit and utilize it. You know, I'm a robotic surgeon by training too. And, you know, robot was initially created by Department of Defense to be able to operate in those remote fields, right? War zones. But very soon you realize, well, if the doctor's not at the bedside, who's going to take liability? And how are you going to do that? So even though that capability was there from the get-go for each of these robotic companies, that didn't really get deployed. And the physician and the surgical team had to be in the room to be able to do the surgery. In fact, I mean, there's just very recently someone has done remote surgery. But, you know, even, you know, at this point, like, robotics can do basic gallbladder surgery, or can do, you know, basic appendectomy. I mean, there are some very standardized surgeries that can be done by the robot. But again, who's going to take the liability?
So Dr. Garg, as usual, this goes by really fast and we're almost, you know, at time. So thank you for being on our show today. And any last thoughts for our listeners? Anything you would like to share or leave them with at the end?
I think the biggest is that, you know, the future is here, right? We cannot be afraid of it. So we have to embrace it. And that's what I tell my colleagues, my peers, physician colleagues, right? Let's see what are the positives that we can take away. There are definitely negatives and things that we have to worry about. And of course, it takes away the human factor. I mean, AI can talk very sweetly, but yes, I mean, it does take away the human factor. But, you know, is there going to be a generational difference in adaptation of that and acceptance? I mean, the millennials versus the baby boomers. But, you know, we as physicians and, you know, in healthcare world, we have to lead that and not sit back and let it define us, like we did with EMR. We let it do with the whole payer insurance system, right? And the political environment around healthcare. So let's not let that happen with AI technology.
I think that's great advice. You have to embrace the change and, you know, be a part of the change so that you can contribute to it and shape it so that for the greater good. So thank you, Dr. Garg. Pleasure having you on our show today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.